From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Julie Shaw, who has co-written with Laura Major the new book, What to Expect When You're Expecting Robots. For however smart your Roomba or Alexa might seem, historically, robots have been, well, fairly dumb. They are unable to do much more than specific tasks meant to make our lives easier. However, new robots are on the way, and these new advanced machines will live and work with us, not just for us. They'll drive on roads and sidewalks, ferry deliveries within buildings, stock shelves in stores, and coordinate teams of doctors and nurses. An exciting future with this new breed of robots? Well, let's hope so, but let's make sure we ask the right questions first. Julie Shaw, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's really nice to have you, and we both very much enjoyed your book. Why don't we start with commercial aviation, which was one of the first industries to really embrace human-robot interaction. How has that played out for us, and what have we learned?
Yeah, so my background is as an aerospace engineer. These days, I'm an AI researcher and a roboticist, and I work on developing AI and intelligent machines that understand people, model people, to enable them to work more effectively with people. And the roots of this, as we think about how we can integrate more robots to enhance, our daily lives, how we make that work. There's enormous potential to translate the very hard-earned insights from aviation over decades that we've learned the hard way through, plane crashes, about how it is we design a more effective human-machine, human-robot partnership. And, one of the things that we know is that, it requires that, not only that we develop a system that's more capable and more intelligent, but that we actually design that system to work effectively with people, and that we give people the proper training and sort of the team training between the human and the machine, so that the human and the machine can each sort of co-evolve to be able to collaborate effectively. And that human-machine partnership that we've honed in aviation is one of the key reasons we have, the safest air transportation system in the world. And so now how do we produce that on our city sidewalks and streets?
And that collaboration has been so successful, as you have said, and we've learned so much. And one of the things that we learned, that there was a 2002 crash between a commercial airliner and a cargo plane when the human pilots did not know if they should listen to the FAA human in the tower, or if they should listen to the robot. Can you talk about what we learned from that specific accident?
Yes. So in this case, this is a crash over Germany. And in an effort to make our skies safer, we introduced this automated system on board the aircraft so that when two airplanes were on a collision course, the system would tell the pilots what to do, sort of pull up or nose down so that the planes, don't collide. Previously, the seat confliction was handled by the ground, by air traffic control. And, in this particular incident, you had this, unlucky scenario, but one that's really inevitable to arise, for any system that's at scale, which is that when the two aircraft were on a collision course, the automation on board told the pilot one thing, and the air traffic controller on the ground told the pilots to do something else, and they were conflicting. It's sort of like getting in and out of an elevator, like when you step to the right and at the same time we step to the left. You need to both like synchronize and take the appropriate action to move around one another. And, everybody lost their lives in that crash. It was enormously tragic. And really the challenge is not when we have sort of automation or say, autonomous cars fully on our roads, or even when we have sort of humans in control of everything. The really challenging bit is this mix of human and automation and understanding the transfer of control authority and how one defers to another in any critical moment. And our skies are relatively well structured compared to our daily lives. And so the key challenge here is to design our society and design the intelligence of these systems to be able to mediate and negotiate this sort of constant transition of control authority that that we negotiate so easily as people on a daily basis.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Julie Shaw. She is a roboticist at MIT and an associate dean of Social Implications and Responsibilities of Computing. She's co-written a new book called What to Expect When You're Expecting Robots. And I just chuckle at that title, Julie, because, of course, this is a title chosen by two women who probably have at some point in their lives read the book What to Expect When You're Expecting, which is another topic altogether. I think it is so interesting that you blend your career between being a roboticist and, as you said before, an aerospace engineer and this human element of computing that and AI and roboticists that robotics, excuse me, that previously has been, it seems like, not really in existence too much. There's always talk about needing the human element, but somehow it goes missing. Could you just comment on that?
Yeah. A key part of my work in both developing AI, like AI decision support systems for pilots or nurses and doctors, as well as my lab develops collaborative robots that work alongside people in factories to build planes and build cars. And a key part of this is working to deeply understand the relative strengths of humans and AI or humans and the machines, and then developing the technology to be able to sort of harness those relative strengths. And the thing about AI is that it's very good at performing a task that's well defined that we as humans structure for it. In contrast, it's our humans' natural ability to structure an unstructured problem. So there's a natural complement there. But to bridge that for, to solve, the more complex tasks, like even just like making breakfast in your kitchen is a complex task. It is constant, there's constant change in how you want it done from day to day. Things move around your kitchen, et cetera. But technology, machines can do these well-defined tasks today. And the key question is how we integrate them. And that requires reframing the AI problem so that they're intelligent enough to integrate, but it also requires, rethinking how we design our everyday world, our homes, our environments, our city streets, our crosswalks, so that we can better accommodate these systems too.
Julie, there's an ongoing joke at our house where, and I think it came from Steve Jobs and, Apple products being so intuitive. And every time some level of computing goes wrong at our house, my husband always says, oh, yeah, it's so intuitive. And the joke is that it's not intuitive. And it just hits home, like for all of us, sometimes we wish we didn't have to deal with robotics and computing and because it doesn't seem intuitive at all. To what degree do you think we're solving the problem, or is it decades out?
Well, intuitive user interfaces are key, and they require some careful study and careful implementation. And the key there is designing these systems to be able to enable a person to quickly understand the intent or the behavior of that system, or how they can change its behavior. I think one of the key challenges is that machines will never truly be intuitive to us the way another human is intuitive to us. They have different processing capabilities, different sensors. They receive information about the world process it and act on it differently than us. And so really, I like to look at this in terms of shared mental models. How is it we can sort of bridge the quote-unquote mental model of the machine of the world and the model it has of us with the model we have of the world And how are we able to transfer the relevant aspects of how we see and behave in the world to the machine? And that's something deeper than a user interface. We have a much broader design space in the actual AI of the system. No person is fully autonomous or fully independent. And especially, people with different capabilities, we accommodate them, and our crosswalks are set up to clearly demarcate like bikes versus pedestrians, because people on bikes and pedestrians have different capabilities. And we need to be able to do the same thing for these robots too. It's not about just designing a more capable, independent system. It's about designing society and even our social norms to make these systems more quote unquote intuitive.
Julie, most people I speak with are really interested and looking forward to autonomous vehicles in the future. And as it turns out, they're also interested in having stuff brought to them, if it's food, if it's supplies, if it's an Amazon or another online vendor. And they want these services. And you live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I used to live across the river in the Back Bay. These are crowded areas, a lot of people, and there's a lot of traffic. And then you add the future, which may have a whole bunch of robots and from different manufacturers and different operating environments that are going to be doing deliveries on the sidewalks of Cambridge and in Boston. So the question is, what's it going to be like to interact with all of these robots in these high-density areas?
Well, I think we have some indication, even today. So it's just a year or two ago. In San Francisco, there were actually so many startups testing sidewalk delivery robots that the elderly, people with disabilities, went to the city and said they didn't feel safe. Casually, I would go to meetings and just hear someone saying, these sidewalk delivery robots are a disaster. I just feel like unsafe when they're around me. And there was this sense that these systems don't understand them. There's a lot of them. They're crowding out our own space. And the result of that was those systems were banned at that time from the most populated areas of the city and relegated to an industrial sector. And then there were limits placed on how many could operate on any city sidewalk at a time. I think of it as the canary in the coal mine. If we don't get this right, on one hand, it could be uncomfortable or even dangerous. But another equally possible outcome is that if we don't get this right, we don't ever get to reap the benefit of these technologies. And, as we see in the pandemic now, it's just it's a different world today than it was even a year ago, and sort of the urgency of needing these systems to, keep more people out of, harm's way. This is our moment to get this right. And it requires more than just the efforts of any one company. It requires sharing information across companies to understand, the errors that arise. But even small, subtle things like there's never going to be a situation where one person interacts with one of these robots for tens or hundreds or thousands of hours. But there's enormous opportunity to learn at scale across society of the interactions or the changes that one person pushing a stroller makes to the behavior of a robot, sort of waving it off or stopping or moving around it, that another company should be able to benefit from, so that when another robot from another manufacturer crosses you, the next day, they've sort of learned something about you or the model of someone pushing a stroller about how to behave acceptably. And we have an enormous opportunity at scale, but it requires, again, more than just the efforts of any one company, no matter how heroic those efforts are.
And Julie, when you think about the millions and millions of miles of sidewalks in this country or around the world, pretty much after 11 p.m. every night, those sidewalks are quiet, and they're quiet until maybe 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning. So there's a tremendous opportunity to maybe for people that are demanding these services to have food delivered or to have items brought to them, that this be done quietly while we're sleeping.
Yes. Yeah. And that even that simple thing requires some accommodation on our side. So, you know, rather than having our groceries delivered at some window during the day, might we accept, different hours to be able to enable this to happen at scale? And if anybody has a Roomba in their home, I think that's a great example. The Roomba vacuums very, very differently than we vacuum as people. And it can be a little frustrating to watch it. It's sort of randomly moving around your room. But if you go away and just let it do its job, even though it does it very differently than a person, they're good vacuum cleaners. They do a nice job. And when you come back, your floor is clean. And so these are the ways that we can think about accommodating these robots so that we can. So it's not more than just a few people that benefit, and it's a hassle to a few others, but that we can really use them for broader sections of society.
Julia, it was about a month ago we spoke with Anthony Townsend, and he wrote a book called Ghost Roads. And his point that he was making is along the lines of this conversation, where he's saying, in the news and the media, we have been fed so much about the driverless cars coming to market. But really what we ought to be looking out for is these systems of deliveries. And that seems like such a, as we all know, during the last 7 months of COVID, we've been doing a lot more online shopping. And it seems so archaic the way the packages are delivered. You know, this huge box truck pulls up in front of your house. It's very noisy. You know, a person gets out and drops off this box and then goes on. It seems very inefficient. How much and to what degree are companies like Amazon pushing in this direction, where they're helping people like you and your co-author, Laura Major, who is the chief technology officer at Aptiv, which deals in autonomous mobility?
Yeah, I think it's enormously exciting, and we are on the cusp of this, and we do see these early successful examples in certain cities, but also sort of scaling. Amazon's efforts are scaling across neighborhoods in many different locations. So I think we have the potential here to use these systems in a way that really, really benefit us. And equally, there's no simple upside to any of these technologies. Any new technology like this, we also need to be very thoughtful about who has access to these technologies, who benefits from it, who ought to have access, who ought to benefit, and then the other effects. Where are these technologies tested? These are never technologies that will just be perfect out of the box in any new neighborhood or any new setting. But necessarily we need them in our everyday world so that, we can accelerate the development of them. I think we're just at the beginning, and there's enormous potential. There's also enormous potential at scale of being able to collect and share the learnings or even just the data that drives the system. I think one of the key things is, how do we train these systems? Well, we develop these large data sets that are annotated. So to help a system understand objects in the world, there's many, many pictures of city streets with people, bike annotated, person annotated, car annotated. But what do we need beyond that for these systems? We need annotations of social interactions or labels of, when a passing of a robot around a person in a crowded area went smoothly, or when there was something that was less desirable about it. And these are very subtle things to be able to capture automatically or to be able to label. But those efforts, as more and more people are working in this space, those efforts are really going to accelerate the capability of these systems.
Julie, I think it was about a decade ago where I first heard about drones delivering pizzas. And for anyone who has had a drone fly over their head, we know how noisy they are. And funny, I heard one of our city councilors here in Park City say, as soon as we have drones flying overhead, I'm leaving town. And where are we with drone technology? Because they are so noisy. Will there ever be silent? Is that a possibility as a delivery mechanism?
Yeah. My lab, over the years, I have flown drones too, but my lab abuts a number of outstanding faculty who have robotics labs in this area. And when the drones are flying, they are noisy. That's sort of the nature of it. Noise pollution is a thing. And that's another form of impact, right? And you think about that in terms of even just people whose houses are near airports, the sort of complexity around selecting or changing traffic or air traffic patterns around neighborhoods. And those can have significant effects on maybe property values. So these are things that we do need to be talking about and working through right at the beginning. It's there's no benefit or rationale for deferring these types of considerations and negotiations and discussions. And it's something that requires input from the rest of us. We're all stakeholders in these technologies too. Is it a deal breaker? I don't think so. It's a matter of working this out, right? Suburbs can be very noisy. People have very noisy lawnmowers. but nonetheless, they are real impacts on people. Yep.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Julie Shaw, who has co-written with Laura Major the new book, What to Expect When You're Expecting Robots. A little bit about Julie. She's a roboticist at MIT in Cambridge, Associate Dean of Social Implications and Responsibilities of Computing. She directs the Interactive Robotics Group in the Schwarzman College of Computing at MIT. She was a Radcliffe Fellow, received a National Science Foundation Career Award, and has been named one of MIT Review's Innovators Under 35. And so we know a little bit about you. Of course, we don't know if you're a Pat, Sox, Bruins, or Celtic fan. And can you help us? Can you help me there?
Well, what I have to tell you is I have lived now in Cambridge or Boston between the two for longer than I lived in New Jersey growing up. But okay. I am from New Jersey originally, so it's
all right.
What I can give you is I often rely on Tom Brady as an example of outstanding team leadership and outstanding teamwork in my talks, and so that's what I can give you.
Oh, good to hear. we have huge expectations to think that we can collaborate with these devices, but we need to collaborate amongst ourselves as well. You have a quote in the book I'd never heard before, but I love it. And the quote is, more data usually beats better algorithms, and robot manufacturers hoard their data. So we only have a minute or two left. Can you talk about the importance of sharing this data?
Yeah, the importance of sharing data for safety-critical systems cannot be stressed enough. Whereas our phone is not really a safety-critical system, these sidewalk robots, security guard robots, robots in our homes, our supermarkets, our autonomous vehicles as a key one, these are safety-critical systems. And, in aviation, we have external bodies, independent bodies that sort through anonymously reported data of incidents or not necessarily accidents, but incidents to be able to, identify the issues, quote unquote, before the happening. We absolutely need this in the sector too. And it would require a private public partnership to do this.
Julie, we've had a number of robot shows talking about the future, trying to understand the future. And this is one of the more comprehensive books. It really kind of forces you to think. So we want to thank you you know, to think through some of these things. We want to thank you for joining us this morning, and we wish you continued success with your book, What to Expect When You're Expecting Robots. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.